Hi, I'm Spider Robinson. Welcome to Thrillin' at the Macmillan, a series of 8 essays about space and space travel that I wrote during my term as the first writer-in-residence for the H.R. Macmillan Space Center in Vancouver, British Columbia, with assistance from the Canada Council for the Arts. These essays were posted over a 9-month period at the Space Center's website, www.hrmacmillanspacecenter.com, and I'll be reading them aloud for you in this podcast series. These essays are podcast under Creative Commons license, with the conditions no derivatives, non-commercial, and share alike. Thrillin' at the Macmillan number 5, The Best Umbrella You Can Get, copyright 2006 by Spider Robinson. It's probably apocryphal, the best ones usually are, but one of my favorite quotations is what Mahatma Gandhi is supposed to have responded when asked what he thought of Western civilization. They say he replied gently, "That would be very nice." A lot of people will give you some variant of that same response if you ask them about space art.
Great idea. Someone should try that.
What's space art?
I draw blanks with the idea all the time at social gatherings. Nobody seems to realize there is any. There's so much this essay is going to have to be twice as long as usual, just to hit the high spots. Please note I said space art. If the topic were art about space, I would probably get a better response rate at parties. Just for a start, much of the vast canon of written SF and of Hollywood sci-fi constitutes art about space. I do hope we can all at least agree it is not dismissible, even if not all will join me in believing it to contain some of the most sophisticated and profound art ever created. And even some non-science fiction folks have at least heard of the immortal Chesley Bonestell, whose paintings invented and defined the field of graphic art about space in the same sense that Robert Heinlein invented and defined most of the classic themes of written SF. Most people my age remember Chesley's striking illustrations for Life and the Saturday Evening Post, or for Walt Disney. Many experts credit them with helping to put men on the moon. His greatest disciple, Ron Miller, won the International Hugo Award in Toronto a few years ago for editing a spectacular Bonestell retrospective, and ably carries on the master's sense of cosmic awe and wonder himself. More of him later. Similarly, music about space goes back at least as far as Holst's Nine Planet Symphony, if not further, though admittedly much of what followed that has been comedy novelty songs like The Byrds' Hey Mr. Spaceman or Sheb Woolley's earlier classic Purple People Eater, which last was used as the basis of a feature film in 1988 with a cast that included Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Ned Beatty, Shelley Winters, Little Richard, Chubby Checker, and Woolley himself. I don't know about you, but I'd love to see that. And I even know of a bare handful of dances about space. I happened to be married to the choreographer who created the first one, and premiered it at the World Science Fiction Convention in Boston in 1980, but there have been others since. One of the best, and easily the best known, is Kitsou Dubois of France, who has been studying the physics of dance in zero gravity since 1993, apparently unaware that much of her work was done for her nearly 20 years earlier in the Hugo and Nebula Award-winning Stardance trilogy I wrote with my wife Jeannie. Inexplicably, Kitsou does not appear to have a professional or personal web page, blog, or public contact address, but she Googles up fairly bountifully otherwise. The entire Stardance trilogy, by the way, has just been released in a hardcover omnibus by Bain Books, and I'm currently recording it for Blackstone Audiobooks. But if the subject is space art, that is, art made in space, the art of future spacemen and spacewomen and those of us groundhogs with imagination, that's a whole different story. If any fiction has been written in space, I am not aware of it. And I'd be damn surprised. I need at least an hour of silence and immobility before I can begin the first sentence every time. And one thing everyone seems to agree on about space is that there's never enough time to scratch up there, let alone look out the window, let alone make up a story about what you see out there, let alone figure out what the opening sentence should be and type it. As for music played in space? Well, if you mean recorded music, on August 30th, 1983, Gulon Bluford became both the first black American in space and the first person ever to bring an album to space and play it to the world. He chose Lou Rawls' epic album When the Night Comes, title song by Alan Merrill. That was the year Vanessa Williams was Miss America for a few days, and the same year crack cocaine hit America. I have not been able to nail down who was the first musician to play an instrument in space, but I can tell you who it was supposed to be. Astronaut and saxophonist Ron McNair agreed to actually record a track in space for commercial release for Jean-Michel Jarre's album Rendezvous. Sadly, Ron had his own rendezvous with fate instead. He and his sacks were on the Challenger. In 1994, Canadian Chris Hadfield rode STS-74 to a rendezvous with Mir and there gave its Russian crew a specially modified folding guitar. Another Canadian, Mark Garneau, later jammed with a Russian aboard Mir, the first musical interaction in space as far as I know. But I've been unable to Google it. I did find mention of flute, saxophone, and, interestingly, didgeridoo having been played in space, too. But music in zero-G presents unique challenges, many of which have not yet been solved. For a brief hint of some of them, visit http://science.nasa.gov/headlines/y2003/04sep-space-music.htm and see Ed Liu redesigning the piano for Free Fall on the ISS at http://science.nasa.gov/headlines/y2003/images/music/piano-in-space.qt. Ed never did figure out how to rig a usable foot pedal. Others say strapping a keyboard to your thighs is the way to go, but if you like to be able to see the keys, you'll need to be able to hold a sit-up position for long periods, favoring pianists with great abs. The same applies, by the way, to the keyboards of the future writers in space I spoke of earlier, especially the laptops. I know of exactly one painting done in space by Frank Pietranegro. I'll return to him later. And immediately you can grasp some of the problems. Just for a start, every brush stroke, no matter how soft, pushes you away from the canvas, and your paint will not remain politely on the palette, but drifts around in randomly intermingling tendrils. These and other problems can be solved, but have not been yet. The same is true of the second earliest and second greatest of all the arts, cooking. The late Alfred Bester wrote a brilliant essay on the subject for Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine decades ago, and the billionaires who are considering betting fortunes on building orbital hotels had damn well better be thinking about it hard today. Almost nothing cooks as usual in zero-G. The heat doesn't go up. It goes everywhere, cooks in all directions, including yours. Don't even think about bacon in a pan. How do you fry an egg over easy? Water boils long before it's hot enough to make coffee or tea in the typically lower air pressure of space habitats, and the coffee won't drip, and the tea won't steep without stirring. Above all, however you apply heat to the food, how do you get it to hold still? Bearing in mind that in zero-G, if there is not a gentle but firm breeze going on at all times, you suffocate in your own exhalations. On the bright side, the soufflé can't fall. And if you can figure out how to make an omelet in the first place, folding it perfectly is pretty much a matter of letting it drift and hitting it in the middle with a stick. As for bussing the table, let that gentle, steady breeze I mentioned take care of it. Just come back in half an hour and scrape the garbage off the air exhaust grill. We come at last to Dance in Space. It was first done by a fictional character Jeannie and I created together in our novella Stardance, a modern dancer from Canada named Shara Drummond, and was continued in her name after her death by her sister Nori and a troupe of dancers mostly pirated from Toronto Dance Theatre. I mentioned before that a few years later, Jeannie choreographed a terrestrial dance of her own about space, about mankind's drive to reach the stars, called Higher Ground, and premiered it at the World Science Fiction Convention. It ended with a sequence of simulated zero-G dance involving transparent props and a trompe-l'oeil film backdrop by Bob Atkinson. 1,000 fans gave her an extended standing ovation, and afterward the editor of Omni magazine, Ben Bova, came backstage and asked if she would like to dance in space for real. She ended up one of the finalists for a seat on the space shuttle in NASA's Civilian and Space program. I thank God she was not the first civilian chosen to go up. It was schoolteacher Krista McAuliffe who joined Ron McNair on the flight that ended them, the Challenger, and the rest of its crew, and the Civilian and Space program. Ms. Dubois has experimented with the kinesthetics of freefall dance in brief moments of simulated zero-G, 30 seconds at a time in a large airplane performing the classic Holman's S or Vomit-Comet trajectory. Picture the graph of a hot new stock's value. It rises fast, as high as it can go, then plummets until it reaches the basement, then rebounds and starts to climb back up. During the plummet, it's in zero-G. A plane large enough to move around in can do that for a max of 30 seconds before wings start coming off. Ms. Dubois has gone up a little over a dozen times now, enough to have learned some things. There is a common tendency to spend at least the first few arcs suppressing nausea, if you're lucky, hence the Vomit Comet name. But even with her major funding, international profile, and university and artistic affiliations, so far nobody is offering to send her to orbit. Jeannie, thanks to the unexpected generosity of Dr. Peter Diamandis, CEO of Zero-G Corp., will finally get to dance in that sort of simulated Zero-G in just a few months. But she's never stopped choreographing for it in her mind, and is currently in the process of testing whether the state-of-the-art in computer graphics has progressed far enough yet to allow her to at least present an animated CGI representation of Zero-G dance on screen that will be realistic enough and persuasive enough to demonstrate even to those with visually challenged imaginations the incredible power, majesty, and grandeur that will occur when we finally place mankind's third oldest art, dance, against the backdrop of the infinite universe. The graphic image at the head of this essay was created by part of her creative team, the above-mentioned Ron Miller. See www.stardanceproject.com. And once we're seriously established in space, choreographers can start playing with the sets Jeannie dreamed up back in 1976. Opposing trampolines, for example, or a sphere of them, or outsized monkey bars, or vast circles of glowing gas to dance around, or transparent cubes or spheres to dance inside. I can't wait. I only hope it happens before our names are forgotten. I could use another column at least this long for something we haven't even touched on yet. New arts in space. Arts that don't exist yet. That can't because we live in a place with arbitrary, implacable rules for how objects can behave. We speculated on a few of them at some length in the Stardance trilogy. Water art, for a start. You can do magical things with water in free fall. With any fluid, really. Squirt a glob out of a syringe, wait long enough, and you have a ball of water that ripples and shimmies. Pump air into it with another syringe, you have an iridescent bubble with colors chasing each other around its surface. Make spoiler bubbles with grape juice, tomato juice, orange juice, lime jello. Better yet, make a bunch of colored ones inside the big transparent water bubble. Focus lights on it from assorted angles. Start it spinning. You can hold a big bubble of water in your hands, pull them apart, and it becomes a big, long water worm, a tube very like the appendages of the underwater creatures from the amazing film The Abyss. You can skip rope with one. You can snap it like a whip and crack off flying bubbles. Take the classic kid's toy, the Slinky. You'd think it'd be no fun because it won't go downstairs in Zero-G, and it won't. But put two ends together to make a circle, let go, and watch. It will never stop. Similarly, a boomerang thrown in a spherical space habitat can circle forever. And there's vacuum sculpture, exposing various chemicals to sudden vacuum, freezing them in weirdly beautiful otherworldly shapes, and 100 others. There are people working on them now as we speak. A space art community has already begun to form and to lobby. Frank Pietronegro of Carnegie Mellon University, whom I mentioned earlier, is co-founder and project director of ZGAC, the Zero Gravity Arts Consortium, a huge and well-organized group dedicated to fostering cooperation and interaction between artists and spaceflight professionals. Mr. Pietronegro in 1998 became one of the first artists to create an artwork in microgravity. Floating freely in a tent made of vinyl, he projected acrylic paint into the space surrounding him. Quote, "If coincidence so wished, the colors came to rest on the canvas," unquote. One of Mr. Pietronegro's aims is to develop painting techniques that will work in free fall. Also at Carnegie Mellon is professor of art and former dean of their College of Fine Arts, Lowry Burgess, an artist-poet who in 1989 created the first official non-scientific payload taken to space by NASA, Boundless Cubic Lunar Aperture. You may have seen him on Nova. Swiss artist Arthur Woods sent his Cosmic Dancer sculpture up to Mir in 1993. It was designed, quote, "in order to investigate the properties of sculpture in weightlessness and to test the advantages of integrating art into the living and working space of cosmonauts," unquote. And you can see a cosmonaut playing with it at www.cosmicdancer.com if you like. And the great Laurie Anderson recently brought to Vancouver an evening of splendid work she created as NASA's first ever artist in residence, and very possibly its last, if dullard Republican Congress critter Chris Chocola gets his way on a budget cuts amendment which would forbid NASA to spend a dime on art. So far, even ZGAC, with its extensive international connections, has not been able to come up with the kind of funding that would actually send an artist into space. In fact, America was on the verge of abandoning manned spaceflight altogether until it noticed it was in an undeclared war with China and the Chinese are going to the moon. See my last essay here. But several arts projects of ZGAC associates have been successfully orbited already, and now that manned spaceflight is back to stay, it's just a matter of time. In the film Tune In Tomorrow, screenwriter William Boyd had Peter Falk say to Keanu Reeves some words I've never forgotten.
"Keep writing, kid, and remember what I told you. Life is a shitstorm, and when it's raining shit, the best umbrella you can buy is art."
That's true even in environments where rain can't fall. One thing I'm sure of. Once we start spending serious amounts of time in space, we'll get bored of books and TV fast. We'll feel isolated enough already in artificial habitats. We'll want the rest of our arts, and especially the performing arts. And we'll particularly want new ones that help distinguish us from the poor, earthbound old humans below. If you're young and looking for a career path, you could do a lot worse. BC writer Spider Robinson's 33rd book, Variable Star, a collaboration with Robert A. Heinlein, is available in hardcover from Tor Books. For further information, visit www.spiderrobinson.com or www.variablestarbook.com. This has been Thrillin' at the Macmillan number 5, the fifth in a series of 8 essays about space and space travel written during my term as first writer-in-residence for the H.R. Macmillan Space Center in Vancouver, British Columbia, with assistance from the Canada Council for the Arts. Some relevant links can be found at the Space Center's website, www.hrmacmillanspacecenter.com. Thanks for falling by. I hope you'll come back for the rest of the essays. This is Spider Robinson, still thrilling at the Macmillan. PayPal or Visa donations are most welcome. Just click the link on the podcast page at my website.